everybody. Welcome back to an interesting video, I hope, which leads to an interesting conversation about cats.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Nora has already interrupted the recording, so that's what kind of night it's
going to be.
Wow,
your cat comes down and does that? Like, our cat will be watching TV downstairs, and you just hear her screaming for us upstairs in the bedroom.
Oh, she does that too. That's cats. Okay. So that's what we're talking about tonight.
Is the movie Cats, which I still haven't seen, but I feel like it's okay. We can still talk about it.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
We're going to get into some topics that we don't usually talk about too much on this channel, but more serious topics and a lot about writing, because I'm currently crowdfunding Transient, which is a sci-fi horror thriller thing with some fairly deep themes. At least I like to think so. You're a horror author with stories that have some deep themes, and you're writing that memoir. And
so
I feel
it's
like
all
you're
about memory.
Yeah, I feel like you're a very introspective person. I try to be. And we're both colossally depressing people. according to most people who know us, it seems. So this might not be your jam, but hopefully you find something interesting with it. So, yeah. So
A very special episode.
This is a therapeutic episode, is the goal here. You have been a horror author for years now. So why don't you tell us a little bit, just like give the audience a little bit of backstory about you. They don't know the real JD.
I mean, that's kind of what the memoir is going to be about, is me and how I became me, and how I became a horror author is indeed part of the story. And it started whenever I lived in Florida and I was only 12 years old. I had a scary experience with, we had a flea problem and we called an exterminator. And whenever I came home that day, I had forgotten my house key, but I knew how to break into the house and stepped into a puddle. I remember stepping into the puddle, but then by the time I got into the house, I felt something crawling on my leg, and there were fleas thick enough to like look like a black sock on my legs, and I freaked out, became like instant entomophobe, scared of, you know, insect phobia, and wrote a short story about it, basically, where fleas took over the world. So here's this 12-year-old writing a story about, you know, fleas taking over the world. And I was just scared of fleas. But I started reading more horror at that time, too. Young adult stuff. There were some... I read Treasure Island and a book called Ghost of the Midnight Sun or something like that. And it was about pirates, too. So I was into pirates and ghosts and just kind of whatever, young teenage kid goes through. But I picked up a series called Xenogenesis by Octavia Butler, and that really shaped a lot of how I became an author and wanted to tell stories that lived in worlds and explored how we felt in those worlds. And I wanted to explore it from my point of view, a normal person, not, you know, some archaeologist like Indiana Jones, but just a normal person's point of view on these weird and wonderful and terrifying experiences that all of us can go through, and then the imagined experiences that we can go through. And so that's whenever I started getting into, you know, monsters and ghosts and everything like that. My horror now is kind of in the vein of cryptic and weird. But it is a lot of introspection. My novella that's on Amazon, Red Clouds, yes, I'm plugging my book. It's about anxiety. And anxiety is a monster that lives inside of you and it breaks out. And that's what happens in Red Clouds, is these anxiety monsters. And that's what I try to blend, is, you know, real life with complete fantasy and terror, but to explore, you know, the horrors of real life through horror.
Yeah. I think, like, I've always been drawn to horror for whatever reason. It's always appealed to me. As a kid, I loved the genre. But as I get older, I think, like, the existential dread works so much better for me than a monster or a slasher or something like that. Right. And I don't know if it's because of age and because of life experience where those become way more effective to me or made more interesting to me. But I can understand a younger audience not always digging the pace of those kind of movies, because generally they're slower and more thoughtful, more cerebral ideas, because they're very complicated issues a lot of times.
Yeah, they require thought.
Yeah. And so that's, you know, your books are those as well. And that's what I hope that Transient is.
I think it is. I think it's I've read the script. Hello, I know the spoilers.
You don't know the newest version.
No, I haven't read the newest version, no. But there was definitely, you know, thoughts of, would I revisit my own history? Could I revisit someone else's history? And, you know, there is that anxiety fantasy of, and we all make fun of it, you know, the thought that, you know, the thing you said in eighth grade keeps you up at night today whenever you're 42. And it's true, but some people don't understand how constant and loud that thought can be for those of us with, you know, generalized anxiety like myself. And it doesn't stop and it won't turn off. And meditation helps and drugs help, both, you know, medication and marijuana and wine, but
they hide it. Yeah. But they don't fix it.
It makes it quieter. Yeah. It doesn't fix it. And fixing it is a very hard and long process that you have to want to go through. And it's muddy and bloody and it's very difficult. And I am 42 and only in the last year have I gotten off of antidepressants, which I've talked about online and I will talk about in the memoir. And it's taken a lot of self-reflection and it has taken, you know, that facing the anxiety instead of deadening it. Now, yeah, I'm high right now and yeah. I still deal with it, but I deal with it.
I'm 36 and I've gone back on them. I've been off them for years and stuff. And there's definitely things you can do, for me at least, that work, like exercise and eating right.
Right.
But also, there was an analogy given to me by my therapist at one point, which I also recommend if you have the ability to talk to a therapist on a regular basis. But
I recommend it too.
The way she kind of described it and the way that our brains are wired, or at least mine are, people like this, where it's like, some people are in a pool and they can stand up and sometimes they can sit below the surface, but they can always stand back up. But when you have these depression or anxiety, you're at the deep end and sometimes you're hanging above the pool, but sometimes you're not and you can't stand up. And the pills kind of make it so I can. So like I would go through like weeks of just super depressing and then a week or two of being okay and good. And then it's like a cycle. And I don't know what triggers it or if there's anything that triggers it, but it's, and I can tell when it happens. And,
yeah,
you know, the medication helps to even things out for me. But it's always there.
Yeah. That's the thing that sucks is even with medication and through the years, the different medications that I've been on and the weird side effects that come with them,
tons
the depression is always still on in the background. And you can feel it, and you can feel it knocking, and sometimes you can feel it sleeping, but it's always there because it's built into us. It is a chemical imbalance, and until we learn how to, you know, CRISPR that gene out or whatever, it's going to take hard effort, like you said, exercise and diet, and, you know, lifestyle changes, and sometimes medication. Sometimes medication is what you need, and you have to, you know, tackle those problems as you come across them.
So because of those characteristics that you have, do you think that makes you I wouldn't say better writer, but just makes you the writer you are because you've kind of wallowed in those feelings?
I do a lot of analogies, and I think anybody who follows me on any of my social media or has read any of my books or heard any of my stories, I do analogies. I compare one thing to another to try and make it make sense. And that's because I've thought a lot about how do I feel right now and how can I make somebody else understand that? So I try to get into other characters' heads and convey what they're feeling through the written word. And having thought about why do I feel bad definitely has given me a lot of, you know, fodder to use, to pull from. And, you know, sometimes there's gems. Sometimes I have a thought that's so shaking that I'll write it down. And, but mostly my anxiety and depression is movies that run in my head. I don't have really a voice that tells me I'm not doing any good or if I, and I definitely do have the physical sensations of like being weighed down, but the anxiety mostly is a feature that gets played and over, and I can't stop thinking about it. And it's just images and scenarios, and it can be even from other people's points of view, and I'll worry about what they're thinking about me, but I'm getting it from their point of view. I'm making it up in my own head.
So do you often in your personal life worry about what others think of you?
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah. I definitely worry about my outward appearance. Mostly because I want people to know that I'm genuine in my character, that I'm not trying to present a front. And sometimes, you know, I cut the weird red hair. I haven't gotten too many weird looks on Oklahoma. I'm thankful for that. But there's still times whenever my dad, he asked, why with the red hair? That was it. That was the only question I got out of him, but it was because I wanted to, and he dropped it. But it's still like, did I disappoint my dad? And do I care if I disappointed my dad? And that's the thing is, yeah, I do worry about those things, but do I care about those things? And I have to let the worry come and then pass over me. You know, I've pointed it out before. I've got the litany against fear. I just keep fucking my camera up.
That's fine.
I've got the litany against fear tattooed on my arm because I do worry a lot. I fear a lot and have to think myself through it and work my way out of those, you know, pits.
Yeah. My oldest daughter has a lot of anxiety. And I can see myself in her. She's a very talented, very smart girl, but there's times where she like doesn't want to go to a class or something. I'm like, can't let your anxiety beat you because it's really easy to give in to these things. The only way is it's not even going to get better, but you can overcome it, hopefully.
Right.
She's so young still. But what about with your creative endeavors, your work? You write a book and you put it out and your expectations. What are your expectations? This is something I deal with often.
Oh, yeah. I even posed a question to another podcast, the Ghostwriters podcast. I'm trying to get my cable out of the way here, and I just got stuck on a magnet. There we go. And it was, how do you deal with silence? And that's the worst feeling in the world is whenever you put something out into the world and get, you know, no reaction, not even negative reaction. And then slowly a few good reviews come in, and that's what I've had. That's been my experience, and I should feel blessed that I've only had positive reviews. I don't have people, you know, seeking me out to destroy me, which happens in both of our careers. You know, writers and filmmakers both get, you know, singled out for, you know, just bullying. Mm-hmm. But I haven't experienced that. And at the same time, I'm like, why? Why won't you bully me? So I feel it like it's like, I do want a reaction, and yeah. I want to see people's reaction to what I've put out. And I'm trying to be an entertainer, and I'm trying to entertain with, you know, what I find entertaining, and because it's right what you want to see. So I put my creation out into the world, hoping that other people will be entertained by what I think is a fascinating thought. And some people are. I think you and Ian both like my book. And I think there's other viewers of the show that like my book. And that's fantastic. I have written a decent piece of art, and I need to put more out there. But yeah, that silence.
It will
cripple you. And I am working on many different projects right now, and I have things on the back burner. I had a story published by No Sleep earlier this year.
And, oh, that's cool.
I keep on working. I do. But sometimes the silence silences you, and that sucks.
It makes it hard to keep the motivation up. And it can be really, really frustrating, and really like a really major piece, a part of depression for me, because I've done creative things since I was, I don't know, like 15 years old. I've said this before, but it's like so many albums worth of music I've written now, like 500 videos I've made and shit, 14 short films, but I'm never satisfied with anything. And I think that's like a personal thing where it's just like, I think some people can be satisfied. Like my wife, she's satisfied with, she wrote a children's book about how to talk to another child who lost their sibling.
Oh, wow.
And she was happy because, like, I don't know, like 10 people, 15 people wanted it really badly.
Right.
And like, that was enough for her. But for me, it would be like, only 10 people want this. Like, I did this work. So it's like, I don't still know if it's just like a mental thing where like, I'm just never going to be happy with what I have or what I've achieved or whatever.
Yeah, and then they scream in the background.
That's Amy. Amy's up there playing Rainbow Six. Sorry.
No, it's cool. I was going to say, I don't ever want to sound ungrateful for the reviews that I've gotten. And I've gotten reviews on Amazon and Goodreads for all of my books. But it's like, I do want more. And it's because, and I think the reason that I personally want reviews and opinions and blog posts and tell me what you thought of my art, even if it's just in a DM, I want to find out what works. What did I do that worked for you so that I can improve? And if someone is complaining, is it a valid complaint? Or is it something that I want to lean into more so I can piss you off even more the next time?
Yeah.
And I do want the good and the bad and the ugly. And it's because I want to also grow as an artist. And you know, without that critical feedback, it feels difficult to push myself, because where am I going to push myself to? What do I feel strength?
Yeah. Yeah. How do I know?
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, YouTube's a place for that stuff, except for it's a really bad place a lot of times, because, you know, 95% of the comments aren't constructive feedback.
Right.
Now you get some who leave thoughtful things about their thoughts, and that's cool. But there's so much hate too, just because people just don't like you, and so they just leave mean things, which is also another like rough thing to do after you created something. You like spend a lot of time working on something, and all somebody says is like, you're bad at this. I'm like, okay, thanks.
I actually, if you look me up on YouTube, I do have a few videos. Most of them are Mario Kart videos that I posted.
I watched your Doctor Who ones.
Yeah, the Doctor Who stuff, the Inspector Spacetime stuff from Community. One of them, somebody took the time to type out, I needed to get better audio equipment. And it's like, clearly I'm fucking around with my daughter. Yeah, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. It's better than like something mean though.
It's just, it's just like, this is criticism that I don't need. I didn't do this to be professional.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Now there's a time and place.
Right.
But, Yeah, I don't know. It's just a thought I had. And it's a thought that comes up to me a lot about this kind of stuff, about these creative endeavors. And I was wondering if you felt the same. It sounds like you do in some ways. But what would it take to make you satisfied with the responses to your book?
It's not so much that, like, I mean, of course I want to become, you know, a writer who lives off of his writing.
Sure.
That would be the dream. But what I really want is that sort of response from, you know, people that you respect, maybe other authors, maybe other reviewers that I follow online. You know, there's, you get a review in a magazine or something like that, and that's a gold standard. And even if your book sales don't go up, you got that review. And I think it's wanting to get that feedback. It's wanting to hear from the world, you did good or you did bad, and this is how you can do better. Because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm always trying to please, I guess.
Yeah, I hear you.
And but I want to please you. That sounds wrong.
Starting to sound right to me, JD. Yeah. I don't know. Starting to sound good over here.
I want to entertain to the best of my abilities. I want to entertain my way. I want you to see my story and my vision and not what somebody else told me to write or someone else expected me to work on. I want to be the name behind the art that moved you.
Yeah. No, I hear you. That goes back to the art that moved you. That goes back to the idea of these existential horrors for me, because like I was saying with slashers and stuff, I love that kind of crap. Like I do. I really enjoy it for what it is, but they don't have any kind of lasting effect on me. They're usually not even scary, like a monster movie. I love monster movies, but like, they're a fun experience, but I love when a movie ends or a book ends and you are left with this thought that permeates in your mind because it's either relatable and kind of terrifying or thoughtful and makes you think about something in a way that a thoughtful thing is.
Right.
So when you're approaching writing a book or a short story or whatever, do you have these themes already in mind that you're looking to explore, or just a concept?
Well, with the Medusa story that I'm working on and mm-hmm. have talked about a few times, I wanted to reframe a monster who has only ever been a victim, and like twice over in her story, she's made into a monster because of an indiscretion, no matter which version of the tale you have. Whether or not she was raped or if it was a consensual sexual experience with Poseidon, somebody had sex in a temple and Medusa got turned into a snake woman. And it's punishment for either one of the worst sins or one of the most beautiful acts that a human can have.
Interesting.
And yeah. it's punishment either way that Athena dishes out. And then the only other side of her story is her death, with Perseus coming and cutting her head off so that he can go and rescue his mom.
It's very nihilistic, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like you are born...
It's like tragic, yeah.
Yeah, born to die. That's all you are. And I always felt bad that a character was created just to be so, you know, corrupted. Mm-hmm. And as I started taking over the myth myself in my own mind, and I've had this thought in mind for a very long time. I've always liked Medusa from Clash of the Titans. She interested me. She was scary. Oh, yeah. It's like she's,
yeah,
it's Greek mythology, but it's also, you can say Lovecraftian. It's something so scary that it turns you to stone.
100%, yeah.
And, so I started working on a tale where she is still cursed, but she's not the monster. She's still a human woman, but anyone who means to do her harm will be turned to stone. But she's a Greek woman in ancient Greece. Everybody wants to do her harm. So it's still a curse. So what she does is goes, and I tell the story of in between her getting turned into the monster and Perseus, Clash of the Titans. And she raises a commune basically for the abused, the displaced, you know, single moms and their children. Come to me, I will protect you. The Gorgons, you know, that's who they are, is just a bunch of women who have come together to protect themselves. And that's what my story is.
That's interesting.
And that's what I wanted to tell, was just like, even a monster can be a protector. It's all in the perspective. It's all in, you know, the world views this person as a monster, but what they're doing is actually a good thing. And there's a lot of us who can feel like we're in that position. And there's a lot of us who are in that position, even if they may not want to be. And that's kind of what my memoir is about, is like, I've been angry with my mother for a very long time in my life, and getting over that anger is a part of the memoir. And a lot of the bad things that she did in my life, that what I considered bad things in my life, were, in her point of view, protecting me as a child. And it's difficult to reconcile that whenever you're on the receiving end of it. But I wanted to also tell a story. So with Medusa, I made this sort of, you know, matriarchal character. And so, yeah, I am coming at it from an angle. And I do want to tell a story that's still fun and Greek mythology and entertaining and horrific and adventurous, but says that, you know, the mistreated still deserve their place.
Yeah, I like what you said about the perspectives, because it's easy to paint her character in at least the way she's portrayed in like Clash of the Titans and stuff is just right. Like straight 100% evil. But like usual, the most interesting villains usually have some sort of tragic backstory that makes them go that direction. And so that's really, I like that idea. I think that sounds really original too, where you're going with this. I'll be eager to check it out when you're done. I assume you're not near done with it yet.
I have a first draft, actually. Cool. I have the bare bones, and there are things that I do want to put into it. And there are some like bad religious jokes that I want to kind of throw in.
Gotcha.
That's the angle that I'm going at, is it's definitely ancient Greece. It is fully aware of the mythology, but I have them speak how we speak. There's swearing, there's, you know, cultural references, but they're for the area, because Medusa is actually an Ethiopian legend that the Greeks took. The Ethiopians at the time, it was spelled different, but it was still Ethiopia. But clearly African, black. So my Medusa is a black woman. And most of the people on her island are black, but there are also Greeks there as well. So there is the cultural differences. And I kind of explore that both through, she's just a normal human who's been affected by the gods. And then she meets Perseus, who is half a god. So there's even more cultural layers to it to explore.
So I've never written a novel, but I do write a lot of scripts. I think this is probably easier in script writing, insofar as I can write 90 pages, and generally it's considered a page a minute, right? And there's books out there, Save the Cat and stuff, that say, hey, when you get to this page, you should have, you know, an inciting incident and stuff. I don't follow that book, but because I watch so many movies, I think it's like a natural inclination of when I'm telling my story that, oh, around this time, actually, yeah, it kind of does line up with Save the Cat. This inciting incident reveals itself, and I can go back and I can read it over and over again, and I feel like pace is off here, but change it. I can feel it. I can see it in my head as a movie. You don't have that when you're writing a novel. There's no, it could be it's whatever the story dictates, right? Because it could be 50 pages or it could be 500.
Well, the length of a story, yes, it can be anything. But you do have to follow a narrative structure even within, you know, written storytelling. And you can change those things up and you can drag sequences on, especially if they're interesting.
Yeah.
But that's why you have to have, like, that's what they call the hook. You've got to get someone in the first, you know, sentence, really.
Right.
And then the first paragraph, they've got to keep reading. You've got to get them in. And if they don't make it past five pages, unless it's a short story, and then it's like if they don't make it past five paragraphs, then you're not going to keep them for the rest of the story. And I've heard of writing professors who have used markers, red markers, to mark where they stopped reading on their student's manuscript. It's like, this is where it got boring. This is why I quit reading.
That's super helpful, though.
It would be. And yeah. It's a fantastic thing to, you know, even do to your own, you know, stuff. It's like, take a break. Like, when did I get bored of reading my own shit? And do I need to change this up? And am I just glossing over because I've read it so many times? And do I need to have another pair of eyes? And this is, that goes back to reviews and getting critical feedback. It's like,
yeah,
sometimes you do need an outside voice. And that's hard to find sometimes.
Yes. It's a big ask.
It is a big ask. And the other person doesn't want to hurt your feelings. Mm-hmm. And especially if they're your friends or family, yeah, they're impossible to ask, because then you'll have friends and family. Yeah. You got the friends and family who are like, I want to read your stuff. Send me your next thing. Please tell me your next thing. I'll be honest. And I've got a niece who doesn't know me intimately. She didn't grow up around me, so she's actually pretty honest with me, so I will send her stuff. But the beta readers is what we call them in writing world. They can come back and tell you what works, where they stopped reading, or what they wanted to know more about. And for that Medusa story, I actually had someone tell me some of the things that they did like about it. And I was like, okay, so is that something that I want to explore in the story? Because it's something that's towards the end. And it's like, should I expand that? Would it drag it on too long?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes feedback makes you think critically about your own work. It's like, well, where do I want it to stop? Or do I actually want to expand on that? Did they catch the wrong thing? Do I want to take that element out entirely? Because that's not what the focus was, kind of deal.
Yeah.
And so getting feedback is super important, but being able to turn off the creator and become an editor is a chore, and it's difficult. And sometimes it does take repetitive reading until you get bored of it, and then take a day off. And then whenever you come back to it, you may start editing on the fly. And those are moments that I feel like I'm actually writing. Like, whenever I'm writing stuff out the first time, I know there's going to be typos, or there's going to be something that I missed, or I'll have an incomplete thought that I have to complete later and try and figure out what the hell was I thinking. But whenever I can go back through and edit and it flows, being able to refine, that feels good. Being able to do that and being able to refine with the input of others is so much smoother and feels more gratifying. But you do have to work on yourself. You do have to get to editing yourself and being able to give someone something that you feel really good about them reading.
Yeah. I do feel like sometimes you'll get like this stuff is all subjective. And you have to figure out what notes you have to stick with your guns sometimes, I guess is my point. Because I've gotten things where it's like, oh, you could do this with the story. But I'm like, but that's not really what I want to do with the story.
Right.
So that's another aspect of it. So there's just like a lot involved. I don't know how many drafts you go through till you consider it done. I mean, with a movie, it's like it's never done because you're filming and you're making changes while you're filming.
That's honestly any artist, I think.
Yeah.
There's evidence even of the Renaissance masters having, you know, touched up their paintings years after the initial work began. And every artist thinks about their own work. And I had a generous offer of someone who wanted to give my novel In the House of In-Between another editing pass. And because they thought some of the stuff in the beginning, they made it through the book. They did like it, but they thought some of the beginning could use more editing. And it's like when somebody else reaches out to you like that, and that's one of those things of like getting that kind of feedback makes you feel good about the artwork that you put out.
Yeah.
Even though they, you know, had criticism about it, it's like, but you liked it and you're talking to me about it.
Yeah.
So
they were that invested in it. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so I didn't turn her down, and I may not. I could put a third edition of In the House of In-Between out, but I think I need to put more material out to regarner the interest in the House of In-Between, because I feel really good about my novel. I think it's a solid.
Mm-hmm. I read it. Novel. Yeah, I think so too. So yeah, screenplay writing, I feel like is almost, you have to cut like all the chaff. Like you want no waste with a screenplay. You need to come in early and or come in late and leave early is the idea. I've read a lot of scripts, I've read a lot of local scripts and stuff like that. And it's, you can see the difference between like pros and amateurs and where they're at with how much they're describing, how thick the paragraphs literally look in a screenplay. And I think it's just a language you learn that's definitely different than a novel. I feel like in a novel, you have more room to play, you have more room to live in the world.
There's a lot more liberty with prose, but mm-hmm. also what it is that you are saying. You know, that set dressing and lingering on, you know, certain aspects to really drive home a particular scent in a room or something, because that's what your character notices, or that's the reminder that you want for the audience, like think of a springtime room with clean linen, that kind of thing. But you
that
could
makes
also
sense though, right? Though, because like it's all internalized,
right?
In a novel, you can see inside the characters' heads, but if you do that in a script, they'll knock you for it. Like,
oh yeah, no, I get it.
How do you show that in a movie? Like you, the character acts out those things, but
right,
you can only write what you can see in the camera.
And that's got to be frustrating, because I've only written one script, and trying to strip out all the explanatory stuff unless it's like physical explanations, anything ephemeral has to be thrown out the window unless somebody can say something about it. Yep. Unless you can, you know, direct someone's facial expression to like, you know,
yeah, but even then it's not like Bill thinks of whatever lilac, you know, like it's like Bill sniffs with his nose, like you know what I mean, like you have to put the physical act
and then show a picture of lilacs. So
it's
way more, it's like trying to literally explain everything on screen. It is the our local PBS station would air movies for the blind late at night on Sunday, and it would have the vocal track to explain what the actors are doing, like Cary Grant enters a telephone booth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably just reading from the script.
Yep. Well, that's the beauty, though, of the collaborative process that you don't necessarily get with a novel. You work on it and you get an editor and maybe somebody gives some feedback. But a movie is like, sure, one person might have wrote the script, but the script to the production is a different animal, and then to the edit. And those could be all different people involved in that process, which makes it not just the one person's movie anymore. It's like everybody involved has creative input to create
this. Right. And as you're both a writer and a director,
mm-hmm.
how does that make you feel whenever you get into a situation where your initial writing is now no longer the end product. Have you ever experienced that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I doubt any director who writes and directs has ever thought of the movie in their head they're writing, and that's exactly what came out in the final version.
Right.
And especially dealing in a no-budget world where all you are doing is making sacrifices to at least just get something made.
Right.
And so it's never what I really wanted. But that's not to say that a lot of times it's not surprising with what you are getting that you weren't expecting. And that's because of all the collaboration going on, where you might think you're some auteur genius. 99% of the time you're not. You're just some asshole who has an ego. And that's what I am. But then you collaborate with people who are better at an aspect. So that's like AJ is a much better cameraman than me. He's much more creative with the camera. And while I have ideas, he has ideas too that I didn't think of.
Right.
And that's where the beauty comes in. And the goal with why I'm doing my crowdfunding and doing it for money this time is to find those people and work with those people that are skilled in their skill set. Somebody who just does lighting. You know, in what I've done, like I did Very Pig Trouble and whatever, people actually dug that short film, but I did that by myself. It's not ideal. Like, it wasn't a fun experience. It should have been more fun because I was doing it with my daughter, but it was just so much work to do everything by yourself. And I'm not happy with how it looks. Like, it's bad looking, I think.
That was a pandemic special, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, for the adoration that it's got, even though the stress that you've got, you've created something that people liked in a very stressful situation. So I hope that you do take a kernel of pride from that you did create in that time.
Yeah, no. And I think Lily was great and I am happy with it. I wish it was better, obviously. Not from her, but from just the filmmaking.
All artists do.
It's just sometimes it's just, and that's the frustrating thing with art, where it's like sometimes you really think you did something special and it gets nothing, and then other times you're like, just whatever, I got it done, and then people like it. And it's like,
what?
Yeah. Come on, this is not the thing.
I didn't even work hard on this.
Well, it's not that I didn't work hard on that, it's just that I, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You don't know what the audience is gonna find and like. But during the process of writing, I guess a smart author, a smart filmmaker is writing something that they know will appeal to an audience. Maybe you write like what you like is kind of what I do.
I think that's what any artist should do is create what they like. And if everybody else likes it, then they'll be successful.
Right.
I mean, take Christopher Nolan. Mm-hmm. I mean, love or hate his movies. I love the Batman movies, even the third one. I love Interstellar.
Yeah.
I like the Dream Memento? One.
Oh,
the Dream One. Inception.
Inception, yeah.
I like his, and they're gorgeous. I like Quentin Tarantino movies, and they all have a very similar look. And those guys did stuff their way. Mm-hmm. They might be dicks, and Quentin Tarantino is a dick.
Yeah.
And I think Christopher Nolan is a dick too, but they did it their way, and maybe that's why they're dicks. Maybe we'll end up dicks if we're successful too.
I can only hope.
Exactly, right? But they have created something that they wanted to create, and they bucked the system and were successful for it. So that's all any artist should go for, in my opinion, is go for what you want to create, not what anybody else wants you to create. I want that feedback. Yes, I do, so that I can grow. But it's so that I can grow more into what I see myself being. Like, I know I've got a universe in my head, but how do I express it to the best of my abilities?
I will say this about novel writing is that there's a level of jealousy here from a filmmaker insofar as you can write whatever because words cost the same. And so like, I can't write anything, especially if I want to make it.
Right.
If I was Christopher Nolan, I can.
Yeah.
Because he's gotten to that point. He's earned that in some ways. I can't. I'm struggling to get 20 grand together to make a movie, which is, in hindsight, like, in reality, is nothing to make a movie. But so even going that far, like, I have to write in a way where it's like, well, I don't think I'll be able to do that. So I can't have that in the story. So it's just constant sacrifices, but still trying to weave an interesting tale.
Right.
It's which tough.
And to talk directly about the movie, in the script, there are so many ways that you can use just very simple camera trickery to create the haunting effects. Mm-hmm. And technology, you can fake it. You and Ian talked about it on your inspiration films of the one where they made the money or made the movie with no money in their garage.
Primer, yeah.
Yeah, Primer. And you can make something simple that tells a complex idea. And
yes.
What you're talking about is memory.
And yes.
Memory is subjective and can be filmed anywhere because it's just people.
Yep.
And you're not doing any major monster effects. The the only thing that I could see being, in fact, I think it, honestly, I have faith in you. I think that you can pull this off. I think it's a fantastic script. I think it's good. And I think that it will tell a story that makes people reflect on, is anxiety worth, you know, worrying this much about? But there are shots that I had in my head while I was reading the script that were sort of almost Star Wars Force Ghost-esque, like someone disappearing, gotcha. Someone dissolving, someone just, you know, falling out of scene. And maybe you can even still do that with camera trickery that I don't know about because I'm just a writer. I just work in Microsoft Word. I'm not in any film editing. But that's what I envy about filmmaking, though, is that you get to translate what you're thinking about to an actual visual medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that that's difficult, especially, you know, someone like me who's writing, you know, big effects in my head. But being able to write a thriller such as this, you could do this, and just with the right care, and of course with the right equipment and the right people behind you and the lighting, of course, all that stuff is important. All that stuff is expensive, and that's why you should go donate to the Indiegogo. But I've lost my train of thought because I heard the door open behind me.
Okay.
I think it's being able to film what you had in mind, being able to show people what you had in mind, being able to produce a picture of my idea. Here, I thought of this. I think that's amazing. So we've both got that with each other, like a little bit of, you know, it doesn't have to be a dick measuring contest.
No.
But there is an envy to that because, like, I think in words and you think in pictures.
Yeah.
And we're both artists who are trying to tell stories that mean something to people. And you've got to make a tight 90 or 2 hours, and I've got 500 pages if I want.
And I think for me, most stories, I mean, probably all stories that end up meaning something is when the characters work or are fleshed out or are relatable or at least understandable. And that's what I focused on. Transient, you know, this relationship. There's four main characters, but really two have this really deep relationship that interweaves throughout. And yes, it's about anxiety and a lot about grief. And I like the biggest fears of mine are not monsters in the night, but of like losing a child or something.
Indeed.
Like that. I mean, that's one of the things that obviously one of the things in this movie, because I don't know what my life would be without my children anymore. I don't know how I would go on. I don't understand that.
No, that's a big anxiety that I've talked to my therapist about before. Is like I have had those thoughts of, you know, what happens if my wife or daughter was in a car accident today and they just never came home?
Yeah.
And like, I'm just left alone now. What do I do? And there's so many thoughts that come with it. And the loneliness is the most crushing of it all.
Yes.
So I get the grief in transient. I do.
And one of the, a slight spoiler, well, spoiler to the story, I guess I would say, I think one of the most intriguing aspects is, you know, if you had the ability to go back and experience those happy moments with this person and feel it again, but as soon as you take something off, it's all gone again. And you just constantly going through this cycle of never, you know, do you ever get over your grief? I don't know. Some people live with it, you know, you live with it, I guess. But
have you experienced very close grief?
I don't know. Because my father-in-law died and we were really close. But no, not really, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's pretty close. I'm sure it affects your wife a lot.
But, yes, it was very affecting to her. They were extremely close. They talked every day.
My situation, and everyone knows that I lost my mom in 2001, shortly after 9/11. But she died September 15th, 2001, in Talkeetna, Alaska. And I hadn't spoken to her since 1998. And that was because we had had a falling out, because she revealed to me that she was still talking to an ex-husband who had been, you know, mentally abusive to the both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot more that went into it. I love my mom. She was not a good mom. But when you talk about going back into memories and wanting to relive that stuff, this is who I think of with, like,
there's good times now.
Yeah, it's the good times. And when I went to Alaska, I went to an area that it was the neighborhood that she lived in, and I picked up just a pebble to keep with this photo. You know, it's the last place that she lived, and, you know, one of the last good memories I have.
But what you're describing is like a way of healing in some way and coming to terms with what happened. I feel like it's healthier.
Yeah, right. That is definitely healthier. But what the movie posits of being able to play your memories and would I do it? Yeah, I would.
Yeah,
there are certain things that I would definitely want to go back and check out. Now, of course, in reality, our brains are weird and memory is fuzzy, and you're never going to get an accurate picture, even if it is buried in there, because, you know, you've been hit a few times or taken some drugs. But that idea of being able to dig through your memories is so fascinating. And it's something that we all do. We do have nostalgia. We do memorialize. We keep things in our memories and close to our hearts, and wanting to revisit them and wanting it to be more than just in our head, to have this external experience with the memory and to be able to live in that memory again, that would be something that would be extremely tempting. And the movie explores that and gets into how far someone might go and how mad it might drive you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I won't want to explore, spoil too much more.
Right.
But that is one of the main ideas in the movie. So, yeah, that's transient. That's In the House in Between. Mm-hmm. That's Red Clouds. That's The Light Across the Street. These are things that we are making. And, yeah, I don't know.
That's all. My memoir is called 41.
When's that coming out?
I'm hoping next year. I've been working on it pretty hard the last month. Not really an official NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month project, but I have been working on it. I've been gaining a lot more confidence in writing about it, but I am at the big chapter, the one where things go to hell. Writing it has been cathartic. And
I was going to ask, yeah. It's been therapeutic in some ways.
It has been, and facing those things. And I will tell you that I read something about, I heard about it on We Have Concerns, which is a science comedy podcast. But I've also read about it that if you play Tetris after a traumatic effect or event, it lessens the severity of the trauma.
Because it's something you can so easily...
And just like get into the zone and you know, zone out with. So what I've taken to is I'll write for an hour and then I'll play Tetris and I can sleep at night.
Yeah,
it works. It's working for me. Man, so
brain is such a,
the brain is very strange, but I am working on that. I'm hoping to have it out. Hopefully before I turn 43, we'll see. But the Medusa story is called Come Hither, No Malice. I'm wanting that to be my next project. And then I've got two collections that I want to work on. And some stories are already completed for those. And I'm hoping that the next year and two will be very productive.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming and talking with me. Appreciate
Thanks for having me.
And I hope you listening out there, this was interesting for you in some ways. I know it's a bit different than the normal content we put on Bad Movie Night. It's not all dicks and fart jokes.
Hey, I talked about dicks.
We did talk about both, I think, actually, at one point. So what am I saying? Yet again, I will reiterate, we are making a movie. It's transient. It could use your support. If you go to maketransient.com, consider contributing and choosing one of the cool perks. And then, yeah, help make a movie.
So. Indeed. It's going to be a good movie. Get it made.
Yeah. So that's going to do it, guys. We'll catch you here next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.